the 2017 teaching series in the USA, Sino-Tibetan Buddhist Encounters, Past and Present. Speaker Kenpo Tsultrim Lodro. For more lectures, please visit our official website www.luminouswisdom.org.
First, good afternoon to everyone. This is my third time to this university. And I'm very happy to have this opportunity to have a conversational dialogue in this small scale context. And thank you to everyone who's come today. So the topic of the talk this afternoon is religious exchange or religious contact between Tibetans and Chinese. And this topic was fixed or suggested by the university. So it's likely that there's a number of teachers who are interested in this topic. So I haven't made any special preparation concerning the content of this presentation. But what I will do is share with everyone that which I know through my own experience. So the talk today will probably be for about an hour. And after that, we can have a conversation or questions for 20 to 30
minutes.
So the first thing I'd like to talk about are the differences between Tibetan and Chinese Buddhism. So in terms of the time of dissemination of Buddhism, the dissemination of Buddhism happened a bit earlier in China than it did in Tibet. However, in terms of the actual content of the Buddhist teachings and scriptures are concerned, there is content in the Tibetan tradition that does not exist in the Chinese tradition. And there is also a small amount of content in the Chinese tradition that was not existent in the Tibetan tradition. So from the period of the Tibetan Empire onwards, there were constant encounters between China and Tibet in the religious domain. And at that period, during the period of the empire, there were some Chinese monks who came to Tibet to study. And in addition to studying, also assisted with translating some material from Chinese into Tibetan.
tene nga tso ta bok na la ina kwa chu ta tan chu zen tene so so tene shi ni jag yo re se jagir ni sar jero ate
In the Tibetan tradition, there's a distinction that is drawn in the canon between the Kanjo and the Denjo, the direct teachings of the Buddha and the commentaries on his teachings.
Tene ti thola tene te bok la ma so 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 rang tene zapi tene sombom to so yore tene yendi khaksam ra undu se kanjer ta tanjer ta tene bok la ma so so chu tene khaksam ra undu se.
And then in addition to these two categories are also the original compositions of Tibetan religious writers. So in total, there's three different divisions of religious literature, the direct teachings of the Buddha, the Indian commentaries on those, and then the original compositions of Tibetan religious authors. So we divide the text in question into these three categories. But in the Chinese Buddhist tradition, all of these different categories of literature are all put together. So within the Chinese Buddhist canon, the Da Zhang Jing, all of those three categories are combined
together.
Another distinction is between the sutras and the tantras, or the exoteric and esoteric traditions. This is a distinction in the Tibetan tradition. It's also a distinction in the Chinese Buddhist tradition.
And
in the sutras or the sutric tradition, there are several scriptures that exist in the Chinese tradition that did not exist in the Tibetan tradition. In terms of the tantras, the Chinese tradition has the distinction between sutra and tantra too, and there are some tantras in the Chinese Buddhist tradition. However, the tantras in the Chinese tradition don't entail receiving and giving empowerments and tantric instructions and transmissions and so forth. Not like the general tradition of giving empowerments and transmissions as it exists in the Tibetan tradition. So the tantric component of the Chinese tradition was translated during the Tang Dynasty. So this is referred to in Chinese as the Tang Tantra. And then from China, it was translated into Japanese in Japan. And then after it was translated into Japan, or into Japanese, they gave it the name Eastern Tantra. But the Tang Tantra from China and the Eastern Tantra from Japan are the same in terms of their content. This tantric component does correspond to the Tibetan tradition. In the Tibetan tradition, there is a division between the outer tantras and the inner tantras.
So
So the tantric content of the Chinese tradition and the Eastern tradition in Japan corresponds with what the Tibetans call the outer tantras.
Tendi nihong la tarong ti lama so kap kap sa tendi wang karya ta tendi yose ng dosen na tatalo gengha tendi si tendi rojere so jilun tezu shipa yon tendi kotso ko tarong wang tendi kerjio tendi zeng dosen lama so lore ng nala tendi wang chimbon dao tendi si kerkyo re sa tendi zeng dosen.
And in the esoteric tradition in Japan, I have heard that the lamas do give empowerments. I had a chance to go to Japan just this last winter and gain some insight into what happens there. And I was told that once a year, the lamas give tantric empowerments in big ceremonies.
And
they also have large mandala tankas in their temples or shrines. So these are deities from the outer tradition of, the outer tantras in the Tibetan tradition. And in Nihon Ruba, and Japan, in museums in Japan, one can also see vajras and bells and other things.
So, Sama, that's a book, the Sharjit, the Parwankaria, the Dorjin Rata, Terun Ratiso Tatarindus.
So these are all the vajras and bells from the Eastern tradition that correspond with the Tibetan tradition. So in the Tibetan tradition, beside the outer tantras, we also have the inner tantras. But the content, this content, is not found in the Chinese esoteric or the Japanese esoteric traditions. And so we don't find in the Chinese or the Japanese traditions tankas or images of mandalas, etc., that correspond with the inner tantras. So those teachings that most people have heard of, such as Dzogchen or Mahamudra or Kalachakra, all of these belong to the classification of inner tantras. So according to the classification of the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, the inner tantras are divided into three different yoga categories: Mahayoga, Atta Yoga, and Anuyoga. And none of these three categories are, or the content of these three categories is present in the Chinese tradition. The content of the tantras in the Tibetan tradition used to exist in India.
Tani ngama yena tani jagar ni mar tani ti sanskriti ti pecha ti mambo tani bog kheryone samyita tsola mambo yores.
And in the past, there were many Sanskrit scriptures that were taken from India to Samya in Tibet.
Ni tartan rabo na tini chama lagne tini chimbo thonya mandu.
Lagne in man bindu.
Makashini.
Oh, let's say. Yeah. But many of these have been lost and no longer exist.
Tini jemton kan kashi kashi na tini 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 sanskrit tini demma kashin rabo ta.
However, occasionally in museums, you still find a few pages of these original Sanskrit manuscripts. But aside from these, there's not very many left at all.
Pali kanda o tindi yun nana shirdang amani girmandus di thola.
Ni yapu koma song kambula chis tindi.
Karu jamba thola shirdang giriyo marze pa na Pali.
Oh, lase.
Kanda o tindi yun nana tambo ni girmandus.
Oh yeah, okay. But aside from those scriptures that were translated from Sanskrit, the Tibetans didn't translate from other languages, so there was not translation from the Pali scriptures. So in terms of the Dzogchen and Mahamudra traditions of the inner tantras, there are ik jik ni rba. Two different kinds of scripture. The first was Sanskrit scriptures. And then the second were the Tibetan translation. As for the Sanskrit texts, they were originally considered extremely secret and were not circulated widely. And in those days, there was no technology of photographing or anything like that. So these texts, these books, were extremely rare in India. So when the early Tibetan translators first went to India, the only scriptures that were available were the several copies in the personal property of individual practitioners. They didn't exist widely in libraries or anything like that. However, after that, they were all lost or destroyed. Perhaps there are still a few available on display in museums, but they are not widely disseminated. So aside from that which is, in terms of the inner tantras in the world today, besides those that are available in the Tibetan language, there is no other language in which the inner tantras exist in a complete, intact form. So subsequently, some of what existed in Tibetan was translated into languages such as Chinese and English.
In terms of
the Gyanagnebo Yaratin Yubri. Oh, yeah. In terms of the sutras, there was quite a long time ago content translated from Chinese into Tibetan. So in terms of the individual sutric texts in the Tibetan Ganja, there are perhaps several thousand individual ones. Of these, there are probably 21 that were translated from Tibet, Chinese into Tibetan. But aside from these, the rest of this content was translated from India to Tibet. So that is all history relating to the period of the Tibetan Empire. That period of time is approximately 100 years. So the next, so that's the first period that Kempo would like to speak about, and then the second period is approximately now 100 years ago during the Republican era in China, and during this time a number of Chinese monks went to the three monastic large monasteries in Lhasa to study. And there was a few of them who eventually became very competent in their Tibetan language ability. And a couple of them translated Jetsun Kapa's texts on or tantric and sutric texts into Chinese. And they also translated a few Dzogchen texts into Chinese too. And during that time, a few texts or scriptures were translated from Chinese into Tibetan. So during this time, there were some texts that were not well proofread and became lost, and then there were other translation efforts that were not complete, so they didn't complete translate the complete text. So one of these texts was one that related to the Abhidhamma teachings called the Great Explanation or Great Commentary. So that is a that particular text is one that didn't exist in the Tibetan tradition. And it was translated from Chinese into Tibetan. But still it wasn't translated in its entirety, only 20 chapters or so. Still until today, it isn't well proofread or edited.
Then it tastat in Jetang Matha Patini Jir Sama Jir Matham Kente, the Patron Tani, Poganala, Patron Tani, Samagatini, Sharzindao, Shinni, Tinishagor, Stata.
But currently there is the intention or the plan to print and publish these texts that were not originally well proofread and edited or translated in their entirety.
Tini tih kapsa tini yike yar gir mar gir tindi shi denkan to so de koso jaga lama tesure ndukse.
So during that period, the people who were mainly involved in the translation of text, whether from Tibetan into Chinese or in the other direction, the people translating were mainly Chinese monks. But still, Tibetan lamas, Tibetan geshis probably helped out a lot in the process. During the period of the Tibetan Empire, taking into account all that was translated back and forth, the amount that was translated from Chinese to Tibetan was very small, and in this case it entailed a Tibetan scholarly monk and a Tibetan scholarly monk cooperating in the collaborating in the translation process. Very, very seldom did it happen that one person would do the translation by themselves. But after this, cases where one person did the translation by themselves became quite common. And because during this period, the Mingguo Shi Qi Ruba, Republican era, because the Chinese lamas who were doing the translation were not completely proficient in Tibetan, so there were quite a lot of mistakes. So, for example, in Tibetan, there's a word nya tong, and the nya component means the 15th day of the lunar month, and the dong means the 30th day when there is no moon. But the Chinese monks translating, not understanding this, translated the nya to mean another nya, which is the fish that swims in the water. And they translated the dong part of that word as emptiness or nothing, which is another word meaning for dong. And then there are also some words in the commentarial literature that the kusorang soso ke deni pit.
Among us, poke deni tamju nala, poke deni namgin peshut mambo motanga deni tsuk.
And there's also occasionally terminology in the commentarial literature which is not standard or general terminology, so the monks often didn't understand these words either. But they often did not ask other people about these words. They just went straight ahead and did the translation. And so it ended up, their translations ended up in a way that it's not even possible to know what they're talking about looking at it in Chinese.
Not to younger Marta, that must chicken, so strong a jerry of the eating, not to younger.
So that's a shortcoming of translating text individually. If it had been done with a person on each side, then those sort of mistakes wouldn't come about. During the Tibetan Empire, there were very strict laws or regulations about the process of translation. And so it was during this period that they developed a theory or principles of written translation. This was developed 1,200
years ago.
And similarly, 1,200 years ago, the Tibetan scholars also invented a bilingual dictionary. So during this period, when translations were done, they were based on strictly on the dictionary and the rules or theory of translation that were developed at the time. They didn't translate as they saw fit individually.
Okay,
so at the end of all of the commentaries or translations, there are three things. I will get to what the content is soon, that fall into the categories of Gyurjang Shide and Dangla Papa. Those texts that fall within the category of Gyurjang are those that were translated from Sanskrit to Tibetan with a Indian and Tibetan scholar collaborating. And then those, and then Shide, this second category or process refers to texts that, after being translated, were then very meticulously proofread. And the scholars in question cross-checked the translation against the Sanskrit original and the Tibetan text that they were translated into. So then the third, and these are actually all different stages of the process of translation. So the third stage is after the two versions are cross-checked against each other, is what is referred to as Danglapapa, and what happens here is a pandita or scholar explains or expounds on the meaning of the teaching or text to the translator so that the way the text is translated is cross-checked for meaning. And once it's established that this is okay, then the translation is considered to be complete. And at this period, at this time, only texts that were translated by or at Samye were considered to be valid and put within the collections of legitimate or approved texts. Other translations were not considered to meet this official standard. So at this time, words that were used and the way of translating were done in a very standardized way. So it's for this reason that today, when we look at the combined scriptures, the Tibetan canon, combined volumes of the Tibetan canon comprise the 300 volumes. And so when we look at them today, it's not possible to say, oh, this text was translated by a Tibetan from Amdo, this one was translated by a Tibetan from Kham. It's not possible to tell this based on the language of the translation. And thereafter, probably for the next 1,000 years or so, 80 to 90% of translations followed these rules or procedures. So it's for this reason when we look at these texts, we're not able to say, oh, this person, this translator or author was from Lhasa or from Amdo. For example, the omniscient Longchenpa was from central Tibet, Tsongkhapa was from Amdo, and yet this is not apparent by the language of their written works. And the reason for this is because a standardized dictionary was established, as well as a common set of standard principles on translation. And because they were followed, this had the result of there not being differences in this way. But then more recently, in the last 100 years, there's been a lot of translation back and forth, and yet this period of translation did not follow such standardized procedures. And for this reason, a lot of problems have arisen. So what has just been described is the what may be ancient history and then more recent modern history, the connection between the state and the translation process of Buddhist literature. If we compare some Tibetan Buddhist texts and Chinese Tibetan Buddhist texts, then in terms of the, and they're the same texts, the content is exactly the same. For example, Nagarjuna's main treatise on the Madhyamaka was translated at an early stage into both Tibetan and Chinese, and in terms of the content, with the exception of just a few words, 99.9% of the content is exactly the same. But in terms of the Uttara Tantra, this was also translated a long time ago into both Chinese and Tibetan, but there's a very significant difference in the way that the content was translated. And there's a big difference between the two in terms of the completeness of the translated content. And so the Chinese version of this text only amounts to approximately half of the content of the Tibetan version. But there was also quite a difference between the completeness of the original manuscripts in India. And if one looks carefully, then there are also many other differences. And if we look at the situation even more carefully, there are many differences in terms of the way that words are translated. King of Samadhi Sutra exists in both Chinese and Tibetan version.
Dinala tini tsuchigoriz dinala nga zo perna nala mukdang nawa nayang chadma menz danga zo perna mukum thona dini te chadma mare chamajna ko ndo yang takba mare chadma mare dini nawa ja ko nayang dini te yang dini yang takba mare dini dindi ge dini tsuchigoriz mukdang nawa nayang chadma menz ni wo ge bo ge jiri ne ke na khorang chadma mare chamajna yang takba chadang damba
So within this sutra, there is a line that says, or the meaning of the line is that which we see or perceive with our eyes, and that which we perceive with our ears is not real. And when this was translated into Tibetan, the word that was used for unreal had the meaning of that which we see with our perceive with the our eyes and ears is just an appearance; it's an illusion, so not inherently existent.
Zeomari, muk sad meba yenze, tini jirayoriz. Sad meba, wulia, wushia.
But the way the Chinese version translated this word was not as what we see with our eyes and ears is unreal, but that our eyes and ears are infinite.
Tini ta tini nang la yang tak ba kang re ta mare zeni tini ta guna shirtang ti nguni ta ni ti jetak tang guna ti nga so la jagr ga tini sans gari ti pe yo go re ta ti ta ta yo mare.
In order to establish which of these translations was correct, we would need to verify them with the original Sanskrit manuscript. However, it no longer exists. However, looking at it just from the level of content, it's we can see that the Chinese made a mistake. And the reason is that the Tibetan translation, whereby that which we see with our eyes and ears is not real, this is corroborated by much explanation on emptiness. And these explanations or expoundings on emptiness would back up this kind of understanding or translation.
You know,
however, it would be quite difficult to try to explain the translation that our eyes and ears are infinite. We can't say that eyes are infinite. Everyone only has two of them. Neither can we say that that which we see is infinite. We can only see within a very limited space, and so that explanation doesn't work either. So we would, on this basis, conclude that that translation is mistaken. But in terms of a kind of a cultural comparison, there are a few details in, that the Chinese tradition possesses. So, for example, in the Chinese translation of the King of Samadhi Sutra, it is said that if a young calf eats a lotus root, then they will get a sore stomach. So it's not just in the Chinese tradition that this is said. It's said in both translations. So in the Tibetan translation, it is said that if a calf eats the lotus root, it will get a sore stomach. The Tibetan version just says, puts this in a straightforward way. It doesn't explain the reason for this. But in the Tibetan, the Chinese translation of this part, there is a more clearer explanation of it.
Then
So the way that the Chinese translated this was to say that when the lotus root is pulled out from the ground, it is done so from, it's pulled out of mud. And because the lotus root, the roots then have a lot of dirt on them, when the calf eats them, they are not able to digest them properly, and so therefore they get a sore stomach. So this is the way that the detailed way that the Chinese translated this part of the text. And lotus roots, lotus grew in China, whereas they did not grow in Tibet. So for this reason, in the Tibetan version, we just say that the calf eats the lotus and gets a sore stomach and doesn't say anything more about it than this. And it's probably because they have lotus flowers in China, and they know that if they weren't washed and were eaten straight, eaten just like that, they would cause the calf to get a sore stomach. So this is probably because they knew about this that they translated it in this way. However, how it was in the original Sanskrit version, this is something we aren't able to know because it no longer exists. Probably if we try to sort of logically reason what the case was, then it's likely that it did exist in the Chinese version. So we'd probably say that it just said in the Tibetan, the original Indic version that when a calf eats a lotus root, it gets a sore stomach. And it was probably the Chinese who added a bit extra explanation of that process. So during the Republican period, there were quite a number of Chinese monastics who came to Tibet to study. There were also several Tibetan religious figures who preached the Dharma in China. And they had quite some influence on a number of or a couple of major Kuomintang political leaders during that time. However, their influence wasn't a massive or widespread one. And they only translated a very small number of texts. Mainly what they translated were ritual liturgies and liturgies for recitation and so forth. But doctrinal texts they weren't able to translate. But among the Chinese monastics who came to Tibet, a couple of them were able to translate very proficiently. And then there were a couple who translated works on Marxism and Leninism into Tibetan. During this period where Chinese came to Tibet, several of them, or a number of them, translated religious works, and a number of them came to be mainly translators of political works on Marxism and Leninism. In the end, this was how the situation mainly occurred. So then immediately after that period, there wasn't much translation activity, and then that brings us up to the relatively recent times. Some Tibetan teachers, like Tsangpa Rinpoche, currently has a plan or project to translate a small number of Chinese sutric texts into Tibetan. And a great deal of Tibetan works are being translated into Chinese. So Khampo Sodaiji and his cohort, for example, are doing a great deal of translation. And also a lot translated and there's a lot being translated. And a lot of works translated from Tibetan into English. And the greatest current problem is a lack of standardization or uniformity in terms of terminology. Because we haven't made an appropriate dictionary. So it's just like if we are building a house, it's necessary for us to first construct or to first make the mud bricks and to have the iron frame, and only then can we begin to build the house. So even though we're building a lot of houses, the bricks and the iron frame that we're using is not a particularly standardized type. And so this leads to houses that have a very strange form. And so for this reason, I have great hope that we are able to develop an English Tibetan and Chinese Tibetan dictionaries for translating Buddhism. This is probably the process that takes place all around the world, but certainly in terms of Tibet's own experience 1200 years ago, first establishing a dictionary and principles of translation enable the fruits of translation to be very good. This is our historical experience.
gyabu nika tani zhonda pecha ka kor ka tani mdreba ka kor tarese.
Gyabu
ka chunika ka pecha ka mdreba ka kor tarese, pecha ka zhonga toni mdreba.
So, chizu di sempo ka ukapriba. Anga su di
yanchul la shakita, o tani gyada po nika ka pecha zhonga, nika kanti re mdreba kanti tarese.
Okay, so what we've covered is the textual connections or correspondences between the Chinese and Tibetan traditions.
Tani tartan ra boina tani jag nani yar tani pok nala yuni tani ta gal hojon shi den khya tani kala kansam yores.
And at the in the present day there are a number of Chinese coming to Tibet to study the Buddha Dharma.
Tani tso na la so so me ger ka tani nyamlin ta tani yapo yosa tani mambo yong yo ki re tani nga to ha ko maris.
And among these there are no doubt a number who have good personal practice, or it's not possible to say for certain.
Ina ta yujin ta tani ko thola tani ko san thumbo tani ko tani yapo tani ger thong ka tani pe kumbo re parche thongya mandu.
So even though there may be some good or excellent practitioners, there are very few, or rather almost no people who are able to translate at a very high level. However, there are a lot of skilled translators in Taiwan. But they use their own different words too. And those who translate in the mainland use their own different words. So these are not, they're not really coming together. So, for example, works on Tibetan Buddhism that were translated into Chinese in Taiwan, if they're taken to the mainland, then mainland Chinese can't gain a 100% understanding of what's been written. In any case, a great deal of textual material is being translated at the moment.
And
at in tandem with this great translation output, Tibetan Buddhism is becoming widespread in China.
Tarzina tini chi gyachimbo tini yo marta ta magir kitini gaboshin kitini haliba mambo yor mangso konala.
When I say widespread, I don't mean massively widespread, but rather that at the personal or private level, the number of people who are interested or like Tibetan Buddhism is very great.
Tani Taiwan da janak la yang te zhao men du.
So the situation in mainland China is a bit different to that in Taiwan.
Tani Taiwan la tini te bog chu la tini tabashin ken da tini yo yo re ta ina janak ra o tini zi njogbo ta tini tarchib chimbo zi ro tap ke men du.
So even though there are a lot of people in Taiwan with faith in Tibetan Buddhism, extent it's hasn't or isn't gaining as much popularity and as rapidly as it has in the mainland.
Tene testishina shirdang tene Taiwan la khoso la ngama ni tene ta yishi chulu la ta pa shin kan ra wo ta tene chulu jamba la ta pa shin kan yo sare ta tene khapur ta tene gya nang chu la tene te ta pa shi den kan ta te zo tene mongbo re.
And this might have something to do with the fact that to begin with in China there was Christianity and other religions, as well as a lot of people with faith in the Chinese Buddhist tradition.
Tani tindi yindi tini di jigdi gimtsin te yin sares.
So one of the reasons is probably this. So at the level of monasteries or temples in either Taiwan or Han Chinese areas of China, Tibetan Buddhism isn't making any or a great influence.
Tini jana kan nangla tini ta mangsuk nangla tini te pe haliba tini shichin chimbo tebro yoris.
However, among the public in China, Tibetan Buddhism is having great influence.
Tini tin shichin tebsa ti so yangchi pe na gargin rawo ta pola mola tini te maris.
The demographics among which Tibetan Buddhism is making such an influence is not the elderly generation, grandmothers and grandpas. It's mainly or primarily among young people that it's having a big influence. And mainly among young people, those who have a good standard of education. And so in China, within individual families, people are experiencing some degree of conflict in terms of their views on religion. Those of, say, 60 or 70 years of age, those who came through the Cultural Revolution, the older generation, they don't have faith in religion. And among young people in general in China, even though their level of education is very high, there are many or a great deal who have who do not have faith in religion.
Conflicts
within families are becoming rather frequent. So situations where parents or the elderly generation doesn't have religious faith, but the younger generation does, in situations like this, conflicts or are arising due to a dissimilarity in religious outlook. However, the Chinese population is very large. At the current moment, the number of people without faith is greater than those with faith.
Two hundred million.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The number of people who are said to have Buddhist faith is 200 million.
Uh, 파르디니 사드랑다고 사룬다고 맹켄 딘디가 동시르 니어레 촌 동시르 지어레 딘디제가
So it's also said that the number of people who have chizde bungumang troubles and then yung kung kung trouble.
Da bungumang yung kung da nang chug nang la dini da dini nang tun tun suko yung shok dini zai yore dini ngusu dini nang chug dini nang ba ga tong man trouble tong shi ni dini de la gabu shing kung da rong dini ngusu sarun trouble ma chung kung dini tong shi ni.
So the Buddhist Association, the China Buddhist Association, says that in addition to the 200 million of people who identify as Buddhists, there are also another 200 million Chinese who have interest or liking for Buddhism, in which case the statistics are 400 million.
근데 양 가시거든요. 다들 이 소망 오마 인근들이 동시에니. 근데 소만 라오디니 추소소 다바 요나야 다 나 다바 요즈니 드니 딘디고 딘디 사루디니 시아 멘켄 딘디 동시르니 드니 추라 다바 무스메나 가본 라오 신켄 딘디 동시르니 촌 동시르 증득즈니 딘디고 초학 신켄 득즈
And then there are others who make an estimate of 600 million people, divide breaking that down into 200 million people with a clear Buddhist faith, 200 people with a more equivocal Buddhist commitment, and then another 200 million people who generally like or are well-disposed to Buddhism, which in total makes 600 million people. How many people there are in actual fact, it's not possible to say. These are just general figures that are spoken about. I personally wouldn't know what the actual number is. In any case, the number of Buddhists is increasing every year. The fact that the number of Buddhists is growing year by year is an extremely obvious and apparent trend. So breaking down the demographics of those who are following Tibetan Buddhism, approximately 70% would be young people. So that's just my personal estimate. It's not an official statistic. Students or followers that I have knowledge and contact with, approximately 70% would be young people and 30% elderly people.
And among these
people, there are many. There is much positive impact being made. But there is also some negative impacts as well. There are, for example, a lot of lamas or people who claim to be lamas when they're not, or reincarnate lamas who claim to be reincarnate lamas when they're not, and Kempos who say they are when they're not, who go to China. Not just do they claim to be lamas when they're not, they also do a lot of bad things.
Ani maran drone pe na tini ta korang ga tini mang da ta so la tini pamjur tini drip de anda da gher ga ton drip de anda tini te mang bon duks.
So there are a lot who go to China and use their titles to gain personal and economic profit.
Yena parche tini dokshuk ni tini ni ba thoya tini sam lo ta na ja cha ngap jin ma si jasab jwangan rao, jini jwangan rao, tindri re samadusi. Dokshok.
However, I would say that in terms of negative impact, this only would comprise, say, 15% of the overall impact of Tibetan Buddhism.
Mangchu te tini tele jamba te parchi jacha jarngan rao tini yarmar te tini yang trangshong ni yakshong ni tini shikin te dea tini na worin dus.
The remaining 85% di lamak riba di lamak wanda shina. In terms of the overwhelming impact of Tibetan Buddhism, 85% would be positive.
Tani tindu yindi tani ta ti yimbi gimtsin di pena tani ta lonyong da tso nangla tani nangchu la tani te tapashi ya ta shirtang tani ta ja rangla yang chu yore tani gomba yang yore tani bhog tani ta chu de la tani ta yang
So among young people, well, in China, they already have their own Chinese Buddhism. So there are reasons for them deciding to place their faith in the Tibetan tradition. In the history of Tibet, of Chinese Buddhism, there are considered to be 8 different schools or sects.
Tata dinane shikin chishu de ni ma to chimbo zo mundu ze ni rendo shikin chishu de.
However, nowadays only 2 of these schools really have any influence, the others don't.
Den is chig de gan reze na teni ta teni ja ga ta jang ga teni oh men do ya. De re ndu se.
One of these, or the first of these, is the Pure Land tradition in Chinese Buddhism.
Den ni de teni ta sangtun go ya.
And the second is the Chan tradition.
Then it then you can also book on la yore shena korang chu korang ngon ni shena pe yak bo hale pa yak bo re.
Both of these traditions or practice traditions also exist in the Tibetan tradition and are really great practice traditions.
Yina then it ta ngaso then it the sarje gan chan donje oho me then in doya de so yang chu gargi so ma to ba yang lo nyung so yang tindi ramun don ni tindi tapal jan ni tindi detap ko sa maris
di data ke gyak to na rewa. However, in terms of reciting the Buddha's name, doing recitations and not much more, this is something that is appealing to elderly people only and not so much to young people.
Tani yang samtung gomya te pe tindi ta chuzab mo hale pa pe yang bore ta yin na tin yang ta te something tin yang gum ni tin ri gona yang te nyam tok yak bo tin jilla kia ta to so yang lo nyung so la te ka bo yang go sa re.
And then in terms of Chan practice, Chan is an extremely profound meditation practice. However, in order to attain an advanced level of realization and insight through meditation is relatively difficult for young people.
Tani ta bhog dini te chun rabo yena tani ta te la rimba nama nasok mangbo zum thombo mamo tani tim jam jam ta so rimba mangbo yare.
In terms of the Tibetan tradition, however, there are many different levels and stages of practice. There are basic levels, more advanced levels, intermediate or average levels.
Tani ta tarta mo changma tani jirwa chimbo tani yindi tani yang hale ba yang rambo ta ja chimbo tani gona chamala tichu yo sa mares.
But these days, because everyone is extremely busy in their lives, then it's difficult for them to practice for or devote a lot of time to practice or to do so for a very long period of time.
Then the indi ta nga chu bo ka nang la tani nyamling garam ba pe na tani nyamling chu gi na ta te khorang la jeba gona jeba tani ram ram tani gona ram ram tani tab debo gona tab debo pe na dorji sen wa nyamling ta chu gi na yang jeba gona yang halipa ga jeba tin di yong ka tin jang jang gona yang jang jang yang dipa gona yang halipa ga tin di pa yong ken tin di so so rang ga tin gang nyam selen chona nyam selen sam na nyam ling chok chok dao tin di dam ga mambo yo ki te jim so chi en sa des.
So within the Tibetan tradition, just one practice tradition such includes many different levels of practice. There are more comprehensive or extended, elaborate ways of practicing, much more simple, abbreviated versions, other forms of practice that are somewhere in between those two. So one example would just be Vajrasattva practice. There are extremely elaborate forms of Vajrasattva practice as well as more simple, more abbreviated versions of practice. And so really one can choose which approach suits oneself. And so there are seemingly many choices for people.
Then young rimba ge thone na pe na chu nang chu na de bo ge nang chu na la nyam ling ge kor de ta lo lo hwe na lo chung ge lo chen lom jang ge lo chen de ni lo ra chi mo lo chen da wo den du shi ni gorm pe sa ro de ni ja wo ji ti ti go ni de mo chu nyam ling shi na so so nyam ling shi de bo da wo yin ge de de jim so chi ge sa re.
And so, so one of the reasons for the appeal of Tibetan Buddhism is, as just said, that there is a great spectrum of practices available in terms of their complexity or simplicity. Another reason, probably, is the fact that in terms of difficulty, the Tibetan tradition has very clearly spelled out stages. So, practices that range from the equivalent of an elementary school level to a middle school level to a university school level. And so for people, this makes it very convenient to practice. And so this is probably one reason for the appeal of Tibetan Buddhism
too. तो सामा तो तीन नाला योरे तो मातो बाज़ जंबा नांदे सामा दागा सों डबों डबों डबोरे तो चाचुं गोमा तीसो तो निगा सो ते जो दिंखोर ता जो शक्षिं ता जोशिं ता तो सो नाला योरे तो तो गा सो तो निगा बोग चु मातो बाज़ जंबा ला मै योंडी तो निगा मै मांबोज के तो निगा शक्षिं तीम रोच
And then another reason is also due to the content of the Vajrayana teachings and practices. These, particularly the highest yoga, highest Tantra yoga practices, as mentioned, contain content that is both extremely profound and extremely simple, such as the Dzogchen teachings and so forth. And it is probably on account of the fact that this is really the distinguishing content of the Tibetan tradition that is not found elsewhere. Otherwise, besides this level of practice, there is much that is in common between the two traditions. So probably this content of the tantric tradition is one reason for its appeal too.
Deni nyamling ge deni koryena chabar de ni rupi jong le ge kor ta wa ge kor ta de so yena yang deni bo ge deni na tang ge na la ta lama mang bo ge deni yang de wa chim bo de wa chung chung de wa di ba deni yang ti na ne chen thak shin da wo ta deni de shi ge deni nam jang jam da mang bo dor na sa ro sa ro sa ro sa chang shi ni deni she ge pi jim sin ji mo cho ge deni ta na
And then in terms of the doctrinal view in Tibetan Buddhism, the commentaries and explanations of views are of the view of practice is extremely clearly set forth. And so this is another reason for the appeal of Tibetan Buddhism.
So langsang tamban ro ma to pa di jim kun dang jam na ta jim sam bo yu ji re.
So those four reasons are probably are reasons for the appeal of Tibetan Buddhism among Chinese today. These are the four reasons that come to mind just now when I think about it. Probably if I were to think about it for a little longer, there would be many other reasons too.
Ni tendi ge shi kin da de ga bo de ni xin zhe wo ba de yang de ni so so mo so so Korang chogo tini tani tini korang chogo yakbo re samni tini shikin tim joya ma to ba de le jamba chi kya chim bo tini chi chap jak ta chi kya chim bo tini mare se te ko su su ger ko tani ta chawa ga thoy na re kang ga thong ni tani on de yakbo ndik samni tini shikin mambo par tini tini tim jo ndik se
the reason or the popularity of Tibetan Buddhism is due to people finding out a bit about it and deciding that it's good for themselves. It's not due to any really wide publicity or publicity campaign or anything like that. It's just through people finding out about it themselves, whether on the internet or through other means, deciding that it's good and then becoming interested.
Tini te mato ba tini tartan ra boyo na tini gyag tini chu tini bog na la yar tini shikin te yo an ra o tini tata chin thong ji mundu
but aside from this in terms of Chinese Buddhism making impact on Tibetan Buddhism this I've not really seen
ta te so tam ji bo nga rang rang ta sar ra o res
so all of this is just my personal opinion Whether in actual fact this is the way things are, I can't say.